This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
We've been talking a lot of Mariner baseball. Obviously, the news surrounding Jared Kelnick is in front of everybody's mind, and it's good to have a guy on who knows this team inside and out. And he's also, here's what I'll say about our next guest. He's what you'd call a seam head. He's a sabermetrician. He's in the analytics, but he's not like those guys that are just, if it's not on the spreadsheet, it doesn't count. There's some wiggle room with Luke Arkins of Prospect Insider, who's with us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. I appreciate that about you, Luke. You're not so just dead set on, if it's not on the spreadsheet, then it doesn't count. It doesn't matter. Here's what the numbers say.
So I'm not quite a nerd, but I'm almost a nerd.
No, you're just not obnoxious about it. How about that? That's
okay.
How are you, man?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's good to talk to you. And Luke's a great follow on Twitter, by the way. You can follow him at @Luke_Arkins. And we go back and forth about the Mariners a lot on Twitter. The Jared Kelnick news. Now tell me what you saw. And I know averages and everything, we've talked about that, but 0-96 is 0-96, and he was 0-39 and all that good stuff. And I know often you will look for contact rate, you'll look for, you know, barrel rate, things like that. To my eye, none of that was happening for him either. It wasn't as if he were unlucky. And man, he's squaring the ball up, he's just hitting it right at people, he's just really just a stretch of bad luck. In fact, I didn't really see him square the ball up that frequently at all. What were you seeing with Jared Kelnick?
Yeah, I think that's a big thing there. He hasn't really been squaring up the ball lately. You know, he doesn't swing and miss a lot. Actually, his swing and miss rate, his whiff rate, as they call it, is actually pretty good. Actually, Ty France and J.P. Crawford are the only guys on the team that had a lower rate than him. But he really wasn't making quality contact often enough. When he did hit the ball, he would hit it hard. But he was popping up too much. His line drives way down. Really not. He's not making damaging contact. And why that is, that's for smarter people, coaches and scouts. But he certainly seemed to start looking lost as the days progressed.
Well, and Luke, can you kind of give some perspective? I mean, we've talked a little bit about Mike Trout. And I don't know if you know how many, you know, times he got sent back and everything, but I mean, this happens to everybody, and it's kind of funny. We get the texters that overreact, that this guy's a bust, and you know, this is something that occurs pretty regularly, and I feel like everybody's kind of panicking over this right now.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of panic about a 21-year-old kid who didn't play last year, who had never played above Double-A. And, you know, yeah, so I think he'll be fine. Like you said, Mike Trout is a great example. Of course, he's certainly the greatest player of this generation, and he had to go back down. And this is really part of the process. He wasn't, in the very short time he was in AAA, he wasn't being challenged, it appeared. And I know the month prior to the season starting, the Mariners were playing games in Arizona with minor leaguers playing each other, top minor leaguers, and apparently he was doing well down there also. So he had to come up here and see what he needed to work on, and now he knows, and now he can go back down and work on it.
You know, we're using Taylor Trammell as sort of a barometer in that here's a guy who came up, had no experience at AAA, and then comes up to the big club, probably out of a large part because of the injury to Kyle Lewis, but you know, struggled big times. He struck out 41 times in 83 at-bats and, you know, was really overmatched, goes down and immediately is crushing AAA pitching. I mean, he was just on fire from day one and comes back up. And I think they said he's been hitting around 290 since he's been back, something along those lines. Is that comparable to Kelnick? I mean, they're different players. Kelnick's a much higher prospect. There's much more expectation attached to him. They're different players, but do you think that's a good example or a good measuring stick of, okay, now you see how it works. This guy looked completely lost in Trammell, goes down there, crushes AAA, comes back up, and is a productive player.
Well, Trammell is an older player, although it's just a couple of years. He has more experience. He had more minor league experience. He's had his difficulties in the minors, when he was with the Reds organization. He initially was a big-time prospect, had some struggles, went to the Padres organization, made a change to his swing, and when he got to the Mariners system, then he continued to hone that change. And so he's had some failure, and he clearly has been able to build upon that. And so I would say that there's some similarities, but you're also talking about different people and different levels of experience and different levels of failure. As you guys were saying before, I don't think Jared Kelnick's ever failed in his life as far as a baseball player. And so this is tough, especially for a 21-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and how about Logan Gilbert? We saw him get his first win over the weekend. And, you know, I was saying if I had to choose between those two guys, which guy was going to get sent down, which guy was not going to show signs, I think it's more important that Logan Gilbert takes these strides. And he's looked really good. And we were talking about a particular at-bat he had against Otani where he got him for the third out, and you know there was two runners on, and he just looks really good. But how does he look to you, Luke?
He looks good to me, and again, you know, this is part of the process. You know, this season itself is about these kids figuring it out, and for the team to see what they're made of. And I'm pleased with him. He seems to be improving with each start. He's supposed to be very driven as far as preparation. And so every time he's out there, every pitch he's throwing, he's learning something, and he's going to take it out on his next start. And I would anticipate that he'll continue to improve. Now, what his ceiling is, I can't tell you, but I'm very encouraged by him.
Hey, Luke, just back to Kelnick for a moment here. There's a lot of fear amongst the fan base, and I know you've seen it on Twitter that, oh, man, look what happened to Zunino. Look what happened to Ackley. He's called up too soon. They're ruined. And, boy, I think we have revisionist history on Ackley. He played 90 games his first season and hit .273. He didn't come up and face plant the way some have. And I don't know if he was just not the player we thought he was going to be ultimately or if that was due to him not having enough experience. How do you – when you look back at those moves, do you remember feeling like, hey, that's a result of him being called up too early? Or how do you compare those situations versus Kelnick and him being called up?
Of those, you know, Mike Zunino, I could say, yeah, he was called up pretty quickly. He was playing up here about a year after he was drafted.
Right. But he did play college ball. So both of those guys actually played college ball.
Right, right. But it's still, you know, you, as a catcher, you're trying to learn how to, you know, be a catcher as a professional and also a hitter. Ackley, you're right. Ackley was pretty darn good. Early on, I think there were a lot of high expectations that he was going to be a cornerstone piece here, and it just didn't work out that way. But I don't see similarities whatsoever. Kelnick is highly regarded, and anybody you talk to as far as scouts and as far as prospect gurus, they're not concerned whatsoever about him. I think he'll be fine.
Hey, Luke, we were just talking about it was Friday, May 21st, when Bob and I talked to a guy named Jesse Hagler, who's the play-by-play guy for the Padres. And, you know, we asked him about all of these no-hitters that were going on and, you know, how strikeouts are up. And he was the first guy that we really heard from about the substances. And now all of a sudden there's just a full court press, it seems, on cracking down on any of the substances that the pitchers are putting on the ball. It's reducing the spin rate. How far do you think, how much more offense are we going to see? How big of a deal is this in Major League Baseball?
Well, how much more offense, I'm not sure, but I do think it's a big deal. You know, Kenan Rosenthal wrote an article a couple of weeks ago talking about it, and the hitters are really frustrated by this, and some pitchers are also, and it's just gotten out of hand. And I think you guys mentioned earlier, but, you know, Major League Baseball has been watching this since the beginning of the season. Early in the season, they collected a bunch of balls from a Trevor Bauer start. You know, I know you guys said something to the fact that his spin rate had dropped in his last start. It's interesting, a few years ago, he was the guy that was chirping about the Astros and how they were being able to increase their spin rate, and, you know, sort of implying that maybe they were doing something improper. And now his spin rate has been jumping up in the last few years, and a lot of people are wondering, well, how did you do that if it wasn't possible? So, yeah, I do think it matters, and I do think that they need a level of playing field, especially at the pitchers already have such a great advantage as it is. They're throwing harder. They're bigger. There's more specialized relievers. And now you throw in the foreign substances, and how are guys supposed to get a hit?
How much of the offensive struggles across the league, Luke, do you put on that? And then how much do you put on the approach, which is slowly morphed over the years as analytics have become a much bigger deal, a much bigger part of the game? The shame attached to a strikeout has been removed. Everybody seems to be at peace with everybody looking like Adam Dunn. You know, go ahead, hit 210, but drive in, 100 runs and hit 40 bombs and you're fine. It feels like that's the approach, that the shame has sort of been taken away from, the strikeout has been devalued. How much of what we're seeing do you put on the approach of hitters?
Some of it is that, but I think you just, like I said, the pitchers they're just throwing harder. There's so many more guys. Like a 100-mile-an-hour pitcher is just not that big a deal. Jacob DeGrom, of course, now he's an elite pitcher, but first thing in his last start, he threw like 10 pitches that were 100 miles an hour, and then he threw like a 93-mile-an-hour slider to finish the inning. I mean, it's just not what you see, what we're used to seeing. When Nolan Ryan was the only guy that was throwing that hard, and now you have the elite guys doing it, and you have just, dudes out of the bullpen that are throwing 98 miles an hour. And so how do you combat that? Or how do you, that's got to affect the offense.
Well, so how do you combat it? Because we've heard ideas out there, hey, they should look at moving the mound back a foot. And I heard them talking on MLB Network this morning and, somebody making the case, well, I think they were talking about 3 feet, which seemed ridiculous to me, but they were talking about, maybe you do it incrementally. You move it back 3 inches, see how pitchers do. Move it back 3 more inches, see how they do. I'm not in favor of changing the dimensions of the infield. The outfields are what make it unique. Every stadium is different, down the right field line, the left field line, all that good stuff. But the space between from home to first to second, around the base paths, from pitcher's mound to home, I'm not somebody that wants to see any of that change. But do you feel like it should, or it's going to become a necessity because of the way guys throw now?
Well, two things that I'm in favor of, and one of them, I heard John Smoltz say it on a broadcast about a month ago, is lower the strike zone. Take away that high strike, because you watch it every game you watch. The guys are swinging at that fastball, slightly above chest level. There's, because it's going to get called a strike, and there's no way they're going to hit it. So take that away. The other one is a pitch clock. From what I understand, if a pitcher has less time between pitches, he can't, there's a point where he's just going to have to, he's not going to be able to throw as hard. There's a fatigue factor that comes into that. Of course, there's some risk with that. The union would have to buy off on that because there's a risk of injury and things like that. But, those are the two things that I think could be done relatively easily. As far as moving the mound back, come on. That's a lot of mound. There's a lot of mounds. It's also in, the minor leagues would have to do it. Would we expect colleges to do it? Would high schools supposed to do that too? I know that's things that maybe Major League Baseball is not worried about, but that's a very big change. And I would be against that personally.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, Luke. Hey, Bob and I have been kind of talking about this and debating a little bit back and forth about Shed Long. When he is brought up, will be the 49th player on this roster. They've just the IL visits and the injuries, and we saw Kikuchi over the weekend take one off the knee, and who knows how he's going to react. But does this, in your mind, give Jerry DePoto's plan a little bit more time? Should they? I mean, I know Bob was saying, maybe the fans won't appreciate that and they won't allow for that kind of a thing. But I'm just thinking, if you're, the owner and, management with the Mariners and you see all of these injuries, I mean, it's definitely setting back some of the things that they want to do. How much of a break do you give them for that?
Not much. I look at the roster and, you know, a lot of guys on the IL, I don't know if they're really guys for the future anyway. Certainly, Kyle Lewis is, Evan White, perhaps. Yusei Kikuchi, if he does have to go on the IL, and, of course, Justin Dunn. But a lot of the other players are just dudes, and they're not necessarily part of the future. I mean, it affects this year, but it doesn't really affect where they're going. And one thing you can look at the Mariners, if you compare them to the Mets, the Mets have, I think, about the same number of injured players, but they have, I think they've had higher quality players be injured, but the reason that they're able to continue to win is that they had more depth, and they had more former major league player type depth in minor leagues. They had just better players that were in reserve. And the Mariners didn't spend that money in the offseason, and now you're seeing, you know, a flawed roster sort of falling apart because of all the guys that are injured. But I wouldn't set back the timeline at all. That's, you know, I think what the number one thing for me this season is to see what all these young guys can do. And when you get to September, where is Jared Kelnick? You know, where is Evan White? Where is Logan Gilbert? You know, is J.P. Crawford your shortstop of the future? Because that's going to affect how you spend your money in the offseason and what positions you're going to spend it on.
Well, and Luke, I completely agree. I've said as much as it may have an impact on development of some, we'll find out. They've got to bring in guys to fill in those holes and not bring in young guys who are unproven. I'm talking about proven major league talent. They didn't spend anything in this offseason. They need to spend it next year, regardless of how many holes there are. I just don't think there's a tolerance with the fan base to say, guys, sorry, we were thinking 22 was going to be the year we compete, but because of all these injuries, we're gonna go ahead and kick it down the road one more year and call it 23 as the competitive year. No, that's just not going to fly with the fan base. You got to spend. You got to bring in proven talent to surround these young guys with. In my opinion, you know, my slogan for next year is no excuses. There aren't. There is no excuse not to compete.
I agree. And maybe they're not a World Series contender next year, and maybe they don't even make the postseason, but they have to be considered a contender moving into next season. And that means they're going to have to spend money. You don't want to just throw money at players. But, there's a big shortstop free agent class. Should they go after those kind of guys? I don't know. Again, it comes back to guys like J.P. Crawford. But they have to start filling holes in areas they have voids. Second base, what are they going to do there? Are they going to keep Kyle Seager at third base? Are they going to add starting pitching? I mean, to me, they have to. They have to spend money on starting pitching in the offseason. So we'll see what happens there. I think ownership sort of hurt Jerry in the offseason. I think he wanted to pick up a few guys to start building a base of veterans who have been there, and I think they wouldn't let him spend the money, and here we are.
Well, I'm convinced now that Luke's explained it a lot better than Bob did as far as giving Jerry more time. Luke convinced me. So we were having that little argument. I was being kind of a weenie about it. Oh, you got to give Jerry more time. But no
more time.
You're right about the who's getting hurt. I mean, if it's guys that aren't, you know, part of the plan long term. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this season ends up. And hopefully, I mean, what you heard, Luke, about Kyle Lewis, do you expect to see him? And do you have any speculation on what you think? It was kind of interesting how that went down, that all of a sudden he wanted to go get a second opinion. And the way Jerry DePoto talked about it, I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I thought, you know, Jerry DePoto, when it comes to team executives, I think he's as forthcoming as anybody that I've ever seen. And you could sort of tell from his demeanor that, you know, it wasn't good news. As far as what Kyle Lewis getting the second opinion, you know, I don't blame him. It's a big, it's a big decision. It's probably whatever news he was told in the first place he had doubts about. And, you know, let's say it's a surgery, it's going to keep him out a while or whatever it is. It's something that's a disappointment, certainly at his age and with the career that he has in front of him. It would make sense to get a second opinion to make sure that is really the right course of action. It really is tough to see a guy like that who's worked so hard. He's such a quality individual, a great player, and to go down like that, it's just tough.
Hey, Luke, the other part of the outfield conversation that's been reoccurring because of all the prospects you have in the outfield, you've got Julio Rodriguez tearing it up down where he is. Kelnick, you hope, is going to be a star of the future. You've got Trammell there. You've got Kyle Lewis. Hopefully the right knee is not going to be a chronic thing. And we wondered, all right, well, where does that leave Mitch Haniger? And as time has gone on and we've seen the injuries and we've seen the lack of production with some of these young guys, to me, it's become a no-brainer. You can't trade him. As much as at the beginning of the season, maybe he looked like a valuable trade piece, he's one of the few veterans. He's your best all-around player on this roster. The idea of trading him, even now with Kelnick being sent down, Lewis being hurt, seems, and I don't even know if they're entertaining it, but just that conversation needs to be put to an end, in my opinion. Where are you at with Mitch Haniger?
I'm of the opinion that they should not trade him unless there's just an offer made that you can't refuse. And I'm not talking about top prospects. If you were able to get some close to or actual major league talent back, that would be one thing. But I don't think you're going to trade Mitch Haniger straight up and get that by himself. I mean, he's the best player in the Mariners, but where would he rank on a contender? You know, and really, you know, I'm actually, I think I may have told you offline that I'm actually working, my next project is talking about trading Mitch Haniger. And when you look back to 2016 and all the players acquired by buyers in the summer, like nearly 62% are pitchers. Pitching is the priority in the summer. It's not corner outfielders or position players. I mean, sometimes there's an opportunity like a Manny Machado or somebody like that is offered up and somebody's going to pay for him, but I don't know how much you're actually going to get back for him. You know, so in a lot of ways, he's more valuable to the Mariners than he is on the trade market. And I think, and sometimes when fans think about him, they think he's really super valuable because he's super valuable to the Mariners, and that's not really the case in the market. And the other thing, it's okay to let players walk at the end of their contract. It happens all the time. I mean, good teams do it all the time. So if you're going to contend next year, why wouldn't you keep him to be your right fielder?
Yep, we're in agreement. He is Luke Arkins. He writes for Prospect Insider. You can follow him on Twitter at Luke_Arkins. Does a great job covering the Mariners, writing about the Mariners. Luke, we appreciate it, man. It's good to catch up with you. I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
All right, sounds great. Thanks, guys.
All right, there you go, Luke, with some thoughts on what's going on with the Mariners. We will turn our attention to the Seattle Seahawks. The Julio Jones story is big. The OTA situation going on. Brady Henderson of ESPN.com covers the Seahawks. He'll join us next to talk about it all on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Well, it's been a while since we've had a chance to catch up with this guy who covers the Seahawks for ESPN.com. Our buddy Brady Henderson is with us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. What's going on, Brady?
How's it going, fellas? I was just texting with the go-to guy, giving him crap because he keeps avoiding me on the golf course. So maybe you guys can do something about that. But otherwise, I'm doing well. How are you?
Now, let me ask you, why would you want to play with Jim Moore? Because he took great delight in really messing with you on the golf course. He would talk in your backswing. He would just constantly annoy you. Why would you want to bring that into your world?
It's just a chance to really embarrass him on the golf course, so I'm not going to pass that up. No, Jim's a fun guy to golf with. He plays fast, he's funny, and he's Jim, so I love spending time with Jim when I can.
When it comes to Jim, you're one of the more hilarious adversaries for him. As, for example, the picture that you sent from the golf course where you were making Jim number one was fantastic. And then, right, you know, when you said that he didn't know when to shut the bleep up. I mean, There's lots of things. He brought you what, wild turkey, so he didn't have to write articles. Yeah. I mean,
he'd pay Brady off in booze.
It was quite a relationship, Brady.
It really was. Yeah, it still is, even though we don't work together. Yeah, Jim's awesome, and we've got a good friendly banter going back and forth, and I love Jim.
Hey, well, let's talk Seahawks here. And obviously the biggest news around them was the Julio Jones situation. I don't know how many people truly believe they were going to pull that trade off, although they have surprised us many times as we kind of ran down the list from, you know, Percy Harvin to Jimmy Graham to Jamal Adams to, you know, just bringing in big names you didn't really expect at the time. But what was your thought on it? Did you look at it as, hey, this is just what Schneider does? He sort of, you know, investigates anything that's out there, but the reality, it never seemed realistic. What was your take on it?
It did not seem realistic, and it really wasn't, from what I understood. You know, from what I was told, they were doing their usual due diligence on him, which is what they do. You know, whenever a big name player or anybody becomes available, that's why you pretty much always hear the Seahawks name linked to whatever big name player is available. You almost always hear their names connected to them, and most often it doesn't lead to anything. But sometimes, as you said, it does lead to Jadeveon Clowney or Percy Harvin or Jimmy Graham or Jamal Adams. And so you do have to look into it. But from what I understand, the contract was just a huge roadblock. And I think most people who know what Julio Jones was making and know what the Seahawks have cap space-wise could have put that together. It really would have had to look like the Clowney trade 2 years ago. Remember, the Seahawks were on him all summer long. They were interested in that, but it really, to them, didn't seem possible until Houston agreed to take on about half of his salary. There was no way the Seahawks were going to be able to afford whatever $15, $16 million he was making on the franchise tag. But once Houston agreed to basically pick up half that tab, then the deal got done. And, you know, it would have taken something similar with Atlanta, but the problem was, from everything I heard from talking to people around the league, they were just not interested in doing that. And so the other alternative, I suppose, would have been the Seahawks restructuring one of their contracts. But from everything I've heard, they really do not want to do that, especially with Russell Wilson. They've done it in the past. They did it in 2017 when they traded for Sheldon Richardson and for Dwayne Brown. But the big difference there, remember, those two positions were big needs because they had lost George Fant in the preseason, and they had lost Malik McDowell when he suffered that infamous ATV accident. So those guys were needs. Julio Jones really would have been a luxury, and so they just were not willing to deal with the negative consequences of restructuring the contract because they just didn't really need him that bad.
Hey, Brady, how big of a deal do you think them not coming to the OTAs is going to be, I don't know, you know, 3-4 months from now? Because I think I was saying today, the only thing that really bothered me about it was that the 49ers had all but 8 of their guys down there, and they're in the division, of course. And, you know, that part kind of worried me, but they're starting to trickle in here, and it seems like, you know, they're going to be able to get some work done. How have you felt about that?
Yeah, I think it's maybe the importance of those OTAs is maybe heightened a little bit when you're installing a new offense like they are.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bigger deal for, you know, the offensive guys who are learning we don't really know exactly what that system is going to look like, but from what I understand, they are going all in on the Waldron system. And I don't think it's going to be like it was, you know, 3 years ago when they hired Brian Schottenheimer, and they basically made Schottenheimer adopt most of what they were already doing. The breakdown I remember hearing was, it was 70% of what they were already doing and 30% of what Schottenheimer was bringing in. I think this offense is going to be a lot more of what Waldron is bringing in. They're still going to have a lot of carryover from what they've been doing, but there's a lot of newness there. And so I think that it's only a big deal, and that those OTAs, I think, are important when you're trying to learn a new offense. That said, you know, they've missed, what, 6 of them. Today was the 7th of 10. So they're going to get a little less than half of them in. So it's probably not a huge deal, but when you are installing a new offense, you probably would like to have all those.
Hey, going into this, and I know it's still really early, we don't know what the roster will ultimately look like, but what's the biggest area of concern for you, just in terms of position group? I think Dave and I are both sitting on cornerback right now. It's maybe not concern, but just that one's got the least number of answers. Like, we assume Reed will be a one starter, but we only saw a half season of him, so you don't really know what he looks like for throughout an entire season. We certainly don't know what the rookie is going to look like. And they spent money on Akella Witherspoon, who, when you read about him, he's really had issues with injury and giving up a lot of touchdowns. He got benched, and so I don't really know what to expect from him. And Trey Flowers, we sort of know what he brings to the table. So that seems to be, for me anyway, the biggest question mark position group. Where are you at with that?
I totally agree with everything you said there, and that is how the Seahawks feel about it too, from what I understand, just from conversations I've had. They feel like that's the biggest weakness on their roster, and certainly they, I would expect that they have tried to supplement that group. It's just, you know, sometimes the right moves aren't there. You know, going back to the Julio Jones thing, you know, it's, again, it was a long shot that they would land him, but if they weren't going to land him, I think the worst case scenario would have been him ending up in San Francisco and having to play him twice a year with a suspect group of cornerbacks. Now, he's obviously in Tennessee, so they're going to have to play him in week two, but that's only once compared to twice. And so, yeah, I think that it always made sense to me, you know, if whatever resources they might have spent on Julio Jones, again, considering wide receiver is already a pretty strong position for them, and then, you know, factor in Julio Jones' age, the salary, all that, it really made sense to me to instead put those resources is upgrading the cornerback spot. Now, it's maybe easier said than done because you don't know who's out there, who's available. I've heard sort of mixed opinions on whether or not Stephon Gilmore is available and how available he is. I think that might take, in addition to whatever draft picks you have to give up, it will probably take a new contract too, because I think that's why New England is in this position with Gilmore, is that he wants more than the $7 million he's going to make this year. But yeah, I agree with you. It's cornerback. I think looking at that cornerback group, you've got, it's not for lack of bodies there. They've got a lot of guys there, and I think they've got a lot of guys who would make decent number two cornerbacks, maybe really good number three cornerbacks, but there's nobody there. There's no, you know, prime Richard Sherman. There's no prime Shaquille Griffin for that matter. And so, yeah, I think there's really an absence of a clear-cut number one guy, and that's the biggest hole on their roster, in my opinion, and in theirs as well.
Brady, good to catch up with you again, and I'm sure we'll be talking again very soon. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me, guys. Hey, Jim, if you're listening, come on, man. Take off with me. It's about time.
He's hiding. He's hiding from you.
We'll send the message out to him. We'll send. See you, man.
See you, Brady.
There's Brady Henderson of ESPN.com. Does a great job covering the Seahawks for ESPN. We'll come back, talk about this Seahawks team. We asked this question at the very beginning of the show. For this is for people that may have just joined us. But do you feel like the Seahawks should have been more aggressive in their pursuit of Julio Jones based on what was ultimately given up for him, which wasn't what was being reported? We'll talk about it next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Our thanks to Brady Henderson for joining us in the previous segment.
We just sat there reminiscing about Brady and Jim.
Yeah.
The entire break.
Yeah, we were talking about Brady, you know, having a very light attitude towards Jim, and yeah, they certainly are friends and get along. But I remember many, many moments here where Brady was legitimately annoyed, if not upset, with Jim, which Jim had a knack for doing that with just about everybody.
I was going to say, you could pretty much plug in any name. Insert name here. Annoyed by Jim. I was probably the least. And maybe it was six or seven times for me.
Yeah. I remember one from you. I remember receiving a phone call from you a long time ago.
Yeah.
Something he had written. But anyway. Yeah. He just doesn't see the line.
Well, this had to do really quick with him discussing Cougar basketball during the NFC Championship game against the Packers. Maybe the most meaningful game in Seahawk history.
He was sitting next to me talking like around me to somebody who was on my other side who had some Cougar connection, and they sat there and talked Cougar basketball through the entire Seahawks playoff game, and the entire press box is looking at him like, are you serious? Are you serious? Dude, you're talking Cougar basketball and it's a Seahawk playoff game right now? Come on, man.
Anyway. That's why we loved you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just, you know, pleasantly unaware at times. As far as I told you we asked this question at the very beginning of the show for those of you just joining us, but Julio Jones signs with the Tennessee Titans. And, you know, the reports were out there. The Seahawks were exploring, kicking the tires, if you will. I think what got people excited is that they heard Russell and Julio had talked to each other about playing together and all of that. And that made it more real or more possible on some level. And we had people text in at the beginning of the show, just, you know, how do they feel? Are you disappointed? Do you feel like now that you know what it took to get him, it was not a first-round pick, which was what was being reported, that it was a second-round pick next year and a fourth-round pick the following year in 23, so decidedly less in the way of draft capital. The hang-up for most teams, it sounds like, was the salary, over $15 million guaranteed he's going to get this year, and the Falcons eating none of that contract. So, you know, the question is, for those of you that were excited about that potential, are you disappointed that he's not here based on what it took to get him? Because the Seahawks, we kept saying, well, they don't have a first-round pick. How can they be in this? When we thought that was the price. Now that you see it was a second next year or fourth the following year, they have those picks.
Yeah.
They could have, if they wanted to, have made that move. They certainly would have had to manipulate the salary cap and make room for him, but could have feasibly been done.
Well, yeah, it probably could have. I think there's a couple of things, though. I mean, I know that going into the season, they like to keep space for Quandre Diggs trade or, you know, paying incentives and things like that. So they budget. And it's because a lot of times, you know, when you see, we always talk about the salary cap and, you know, what it says on SpotTrack and, you know, any other place. And I remember last year having a debate with Joe Fan, and he was like, oh, they have it. And I'm like, no, they don't. And like, yeah, they do. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry, they don't, because, you know, they budget every year for all these different, you know, things that could possibly happen. So there's that. And then there's the fact that the Atlanta, and Clayton told us this at 4 o'clock. If you go back and listen to the podcast and 710sports.com, you'll hear him talk about Atlanta being in terrible shape as far as the salary cap goes. So there's no way they were going to eat any of that. And, you know, and I wonder, like, going back to the Clowney deal, and maybe that deal doesn't happen if Houston doesn't chip in the $7 million.
Oh, I bet it doesn't.
Yeah.
I think it was $9 million. But either way,
yeah,
you're right.
It's one of those two.
I feel like Houston ate more than the Seahawks. I'm almost 100% on that they ate more of the contract than what the Seahawks ended up having to pay for him.
Right, and that's probably what they would want Atlanta to do, and they're not in a position to do that. So, I mean, I think that's mostly what made it unrealistic. But, you know, it's funny. I was just looking at, you know, the attempts, you know, the passes, the targets that were thrown to him, and you see what are thrown to Tyler Lockett and DK Metcalf, and I just don't know where you fit him in.
If he were 27, do you have a different feeling about this?
Well,
I mean, I think that helps when we go, listen, man, he's 32 years old. He's coming off a season where he only played 9 games because of injury, and he's been dinged up here and there over the past couple of years, not missed a ton of time except for last year, but he's 32, and he's making an exorbitant amount of money. If he were 27, how different would the attitude have been, do you think?
Well, I mean, you might have even thought about replacing one of your receivers with him. I mean, I'm glad you brought it up, because when he was 27, he averaged 100 yards per game in catches, 1,409 total yards, but he only played in 14 games that year. But still, what do you have? 6 touchdowns. I mean, he was all pro and, you know, pro bowler. So, I mean, he had a couple of 15, 16, 17. Those were just the sweet years for him. I mean, but he averaged over 100 yards per game in 5 of his seasons. So, yeah, he's just a machine. I mean, he was the gold standard for receivers for quite a while. I mean, you know, probably from like his second year, 2012 on, that as far as speed, you know, huge hands. Mm-hmm. I mean, a big guy, just jump out of the building. I mean, but he's just not quite there. And I think for the Seahawks, it was more than anything about their discipline with their salary cap.
Yeah. So it's a move. Listen, on a fantasy level, would you love that talent on the roster? Of course you would. Of course you would. But based on their needs and where they're at financially, never made sense.
I mean, if you're on the playground picking, of course you take Julio Jones.
Yeah, I mean, you want as many weapons as possible, but did you need him? No, I don't think they needed Julio Jones.
Well, and especially at what cost?
Right.
The cost was going to be pretty steep.
All right, we'll come back. We'll talk more about that and everything else going on in the NFL. John Clayton will join us next year with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.